Hi, I'm Connie Loizos.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Hello, dear listeners. Guys, we do not have a featured guest this week. I hope this won't infuriate anyone listening. I'm usually pretty good about figuring this out, but this week I was just very busy with work and our interns slash children, one of whom just nabbed his driver's permit and now is in front of us every 5 minutes asking if he can drive us somewhere. He's actually very careful and cautious, though there's a bare-knuckle experience in the mix every time. In any case, a facet of work that has kept me especially busy this week is helping to plan TechCrunch Disrupt, which is the signature event of TechCrunch every fall, and that's happening late next month at the Moscone Center in downtown San Francisco. I think most of you listening probably already know that in addition to Strictly VC, I'm an editor with TC, and while these events nearly kill me every year, it's so satisfying as they come together. I'm especially excited this year by some of the people who I will personally have a chance to sit down with on stage, including Katie Hahn, the one-time prosecutor turned Coinbase board member and general partner at Andreessen Horowitz, who successfully set off on her own at the end of 2021 and raised a $1.5 billion venture fund. I have not had a chance to talk with Katie since before FTX's implosion about a year ago and the cascading effects it has had on the crypto industry. So I'm really excited to have the chance to do that at this event. But there will be lots of interesting people around, including Shaquille O'Neal, Instagram founder Kevin Systrom, who now has a hot new startup, and between us, Reed Jobs, the son of Steve Jobs, who is stepping into the limelight to fund cancer research. And there will be a number of industry-specific stages, which is sort of a new feature of Disrupt. And they're going to have all kinds of really interesting programming for investors and founders. One is a fintech stage. We've got a robotics stage going. There's an AI stage that I'm sure is going to be very well attended. I have no idea what the URL is, but if you look up Disrupt 2023, you'll find a lot more information there. If you do come and you do happen to see me around, by the way, please stop and say hello. Okay, that's it. You're busy, we're busy. Let's get into some of these news stories. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Affinity is changing the way VCs manage relationships and increasing deal flow. By aggregating the data exhaust produced by daily interactions and communications and analyzing it with machine learning, Affinity delivers up-to-the-minute insights into professional relationships, unlocking new introductions to key decision-makers, and giving you a holistic view of your team's networks in a centralized, automatically updated database without any manual upkeep. Affinity works with over 1,600 investment firms across venture capital, investment banking, private equity, and consulting, where sales are more personal, collaborative, and driven by relationships. Affinity, opening doors to help you close deals faster. Learn more at affinity.co. That's affinity.co.
Earlier this week, I reported on a company called Made Renovation that promises customers that using tech, it can vastly simplify the process of renovating their bathrooms. It also says it can make the endeavor both cheaper and more predictable. A lot of its business model is simply about narrowing down options for overwhelmed homeowners. Whereas today, for some, the experience means either a trip to Home Depot or, with a bigger budget, poring over dozens of catalogs filled with all different shades and types and sizes of vanities, sinks, shower stalls, and other hardware, Made Renovation presents shoppers with a select number of seemingly affordable templates that they can then customize further if they so choose. Even better, after a customer makes his or her selection, Made Renovation has long promised to then pair them with an in-house project manager to help with required permits, assign contractors, order the required materials, and offer updates and assistance virtually until every renovation is complete. As someone who has lived through a massive remodel and never wants to experience this unique torture again, Made Renovation's pitch resonated with me a few years ago when it reached out to talk about its first seed round of funding. It was February of 2020, and founder and CEO Roger Dickey talked with me then about creating bathroom templates whose scope and costs are generally understood, then lining up customers and hiring general contractors who were willing to focus only on these bathrooms instead of being pulled into much bigger and likely more lucrative jobs. At the time, Made Renovation had just landed $9 million in funds from some esteemed firms, including Felicis. And though I was skeptical, knowing what I've learned firsthand about the complexity of construction projects, it seemed possible that Dickey's team could improve on a pretty awful process as it exists today. As it turns out, however, it cannot. In fact, this summer I began hearing from customers of Made Renovation who'd read that three-year-old story in TechCrunch and who were fuming at the terrible treatment they said they'd received at the hands of the company. Though the company's tagline is, quote, "We handle everything," according to a number of customers from whom we've heard since, the company's priority is very much on getting customers to sign up for the service and then not doing much at all. Jonas Heineman, a resident of San Anselmo, California, outside of San Francisco, told me, for example, that after contracting with Made Renovation, it twice replaced a project manager who he never actually spoke with before later disbanding its project management team altogether without alerting him and then spinning the cost-cutting development as a positive for customers. The company subsequently sent Heineman a downloadable self-management construction support guidebook. Great. Another customer, Airbnb employee Deanna Borquist, told me that after she signed up with Made Renovation, customer service was non-existent. Among her many varied complaints about her trying experience with the company, she said a subcontractor refused to demolish more than half of her tiny bathroom, saying that's all her contract covered. A toilet that Made Renovation sent her before anyone ever visited her home for the work sat in her living room for 6 months. And she received a series of scary emails about the financing that Made Renovation had extended to her and that she accepted, but which was later revoked and then reinstated again, but not before she received worrying correspondence about the potential impact to her credit score. I reached out to Roger Dickey to talk with him about his customers' many complaints, and he never responded. He also didn't respond when an investor of Made Renovation also let him know that I'd like to talk with him. In the meantime, I have heard from many, many more angry customers. I was also in touch with someone who worked at Dickey's previous company, Gigster, a talent platform that was acquired by a private equity firm in 2021. And this person says Gigster was its own interesting adventure. I'm glad I was able to write a follow-up to that earlier story. Still, I can't help but feel responsible for giving the company valuable real estate in TechCrunch that might have made customers trust the company more than they should. Certainly, it was a reminder that while startup reporters can and should cover companies that are trying to innovate, it's also so important to inform the public when those companies fall short of those goals. My colleagues and I get a lot of grief from certain investors when we do this, particularly on social media. Some love to harass the tech press as overly bearish, which is frankly ridiculous. If anything, we need to collectively do a much better job of tracking the trajectory of the companies we cover, because sometimes, as here evidently, they wind up doing more harm than good.
Former FTX head Sam Bankman-Fried is spending tonight in jail. Judge Lewis Kaplan today revoked the former crypto kingpin's bail for repeatedly testing the court's patience with his behavior. "He has gone up to the line over and over again, and I am going to revoke bail," Kaplan said. Bankman-Fried's latest indiscretion was sharing with a New York Times reporter private correspondence between himself and Caroline Ellison, the former head of Alameda Research, whom the government intends to call as a witness in Bankman-Fried's trial. Kaplan said the messages were designed to portray Ms. Ellison in an unfavorable light and could possibly constitute a federal crime. He also agreed with the prosecution's contention that Bankman-Fried pivoted to in-person machinations because of court-imposed limitations on his internet and phone use. According to the judge, Bankman-Fried didn't send the reporter copies of Ellison's messages because it was a way, in his view, of doing this in a manner in which he was least likely to be caught. He was covering his tracks. While Bankman-Fried's lawyers maintained that their client was just using his First Amendment rights to protect his reputation, Judge Kaplan said that defendant speech is not protected if it is to bring about a crime. Bankman-Fried's interview with The Times has been just the latest in a string of run-ins with the court. In January, Kaplan tightened Bankman-Fried's bail restrictions for contacting a former FTX executive who could be a witness in the case and using a virtual private network that concealed his internet activity. Bankman-Fried maintained that he used the VPN to watch football online. At a July 26th hearing about Bankman-Fried's interview with The Times, Assistant U.S. Attorney Daniel Sassoon said Bankman-Fried had conducted 1,000 phone calls with various journalists while under home detention and portrayed the Ellison incident as an escalation of an ongoing campaign with the press that has now crossed a line. Judge Kaplan apparently agreed. In his ruling, he said that there is probable cause to believe that the defendant has attempted to tamper with witnesses at least twice. Bankman-Fried will be remanded to the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, a chronically understaffed facility that even Judge Kaplan acknowledged was not on anyone's list of five-star facilities.
Another story of note this week centers on a four-year-old Atlanta-based venture outfit that suddenly finds itself at the center of a civil rights battle. As Business Insider notes, the roots of this particular fight could be most closely traced to the summer of 2020, when the murder of George Floyd and frustration over continuing racial inequality in the U.S. spilled over into the business world, leading to all manner of company pledges around diversity, equity, and inclusion. Companies promised, for example, to consider diversity more in hiring. Meanwhile, some major institutions, including Bank of America, MasterCard, PayPal, and others, earmarked millions of dollars to address the racial funding gap, given that underrepresented founders wind up with a minuscule amount of financial backing each year to grow their companies. Some of that money ultimately went to smaller VC firms that focus on funding underrepresented startup founders, including that small Atlanta-based outfit, which is called Fearless Fund, and which is now unexpectedly at the center of a lawsuit filed by the conservative nonprofit American Alliance for Equal Rights. It's the same organization that recently clinched a victory against affirmative action in college admissions before the U.S. Supreme Court. Led by conservative legal activist Edward Blum, the outfit last week sued Fearless Fund, saying that it's racially discriminatory because Black women are the only eligible participants of a grant program that Fearless Fund launched in partnership with MasterCard in 2021. In obvious ways, the lawsuit is adding insult to injury. Black women still receive less than 1% of venture capital funding. And despite MasterCard's generosity, imagine air quotes here, it's notable that in 2021, it enabled Fearless Fund to make grants of $20,000 to a small number of recipients, and that last year, those grants were cut in half to $10,000, which isn't enough to make even a dent for most business owners. We're not talking about a whole lot of grant money here, in other words. Still, Blum's organization says the program violates a section of the Civil Rights Act of 1866 prohibiting racial discrimination in contracts. It claims it has members who are being excluded from the program because of their race, and that it's entitled to relief. It's not clear what will happen if Blum wins, though undoubtedly the outcome will impact the outcomes of cases where the stakes are even higher, which is why Fearless Fund, which says it has deployed more than $26.5 million into startups in its four-year history and awarded more than 346 grants, isn't taking the lawsuit lightly. On the contrary, on Thursday afternoon in Manhattan, two of the firm's three founders, Ayanna Parsons and Ariane Simone, both said in a widely watched press conference that activism is in the firm's DNA and that its team is, quote, not scared. Simone, who's also the firm's CEO, said in addressing the lawsuit, quote, I'm the daughter of a civil rights attorney and entertainment attorney who represented Rosa Parks. I grew up around Loretta Scott King, Rosa Parks, and Juanita Abernathy. Activism is in our DNA. I'm the daughter of a mother who won the largest discrimination case in the state of Michigan when I was growing up. Activism, she continued, is in our DNA. I will say that watching it from my MacBook screen, thousands of miles away in the Bay Area, I found her speech very stirring. Meanwhile, the legal team they've assembled are formidable in their own right. For example, Ben Crump, a prominent civil rights lawyer, is a member of the defense team, which is led by the law firm Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. Unsurprisingly, Crump and his peers declined to answer questions at the news conference about their strategy, but Crump seemed to signal that it's not just racial diversity that's under attack, but gender diversity too. Here's Crump.
When I think of this lawsuit, Karen, I think it's just another frivolous attempt to prevent the progress of women. You question why the Fearless Fund. You know, Mile and I've been asked over and over again, why do you think they picked the Fearless Fund to bring this lawsuit? There's so many other venture capitalists who have similar, you know, objectives. Why them? And the conclusion seems to keep coming back to the fact that he thought they would be the easiest ones to pick off. Oh, was he wrong? Oh, was he wrong?
If you're a parent, you have probably agonized about the impact of devices on your kid. It sometimes seems like our kids are spending more time with their electronics than their parents. According to Common Sense Media, half of all children under 8 own a tablet device and spend an average of about 2.25 hours per day on a digital screen. 8 to 12-year-olds spend an average of almost 5.5 hours a day looking at screens on smartphones, tablets, gaming consoles, and TVs. Meanwhile, teenagers are spending more than 8.5 hours a day on their devices. In an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal, however, Dr. Dana Suskind, co-director of the TMW Center for Early Learning Plus Public Health and the founding director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program at the University of Chicago, suggests that we need to keep an open mind when it comes to the latest high-tech innovation for our kids, AI nannies. In the not-too-distant future, Suskind posits, childhood staples such as teddy bears could coo to babies and answer toddlers' questions, read favorite bedtime stories over and over and over again, sing songs and play games, and even deduce why a baby is crying. According to Suskind, this is a good thing. Research has shown that rich conversation is vital to a baby's brain development. In her view, conversing with an AI could stimulate the creation of a wide array of cognitive and emotional connections. Why not use AI nannies to engage human babies in the kind of back-and-forth conversation that builds brains, Suskind writes. It could have profoundly positive developmental impacts, increasing the frequency and consistency of brain-building moments during the period when children's brains are most plastic, that is, most capable of rewiring themselves based on what they encounter. The technology could be a boon to children who otherwise might experience developmental delays. It could help to unlock cognitive potential and close achievement gaps. Suskind acknowledges that there are risks to exposing our kids to so much AI. For example, children and their caregivers sync up when they are trying to communicate or play together, and this neural synchrony greatly accelerates the development of cognitive skills. As far as we know, AIs can't bond with kids in this way. Also, she concedes that this emotional unavailability also makes it hard for AIs to instill the same degree of grit, resiliency, and ambition that children pick up from their parents. This reporter wonders what might happen if an AI starts to hallucinate while speaking to a child. He can't get ChatGPT's infamous amorous overtures to a New York Times reporter out of his head. Still, Suskind's conclusion that we cannot put the AI genie back in its bottle is probably correct. AI nannies are coming, people. Let's just hope we're ready. That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. And a special thanks to Affinity. Check them out at affinity.co. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here next week.